are kicking off season two of the Respect the Beef podcast with an amazing interview with what I think is probably a very rare breed, a butcher who used to be a vegan.
So I wasn't sure when we were chatting, on Instagram, if I was speaking to you or to your wife when you said that you were, you used to be a vegan. So now I'm even more amazed that you're a dude.
Well, I do what I can, you know.
Like, I mean, I've met a lot of vegans, and I mean, that's fine, but I find they're nearly always female. Okay. And why? Like, why did you go from being like a meat eater to what made you take the jump into veganism? And was it like a gradual, I'm going to cut out red meat, and then I'm only going to eat fish, and I'm only going to be vegetarian? And then was it over a couple of years, or was it just boom?
It was a process for sure. It was not something where I was just like went from, you know, a meat eater straight to thinking I'm going to be a vegan and I'm going to go to the other extreme of the diet. It was prompted a lot. Like I got really into the punk rock music scene in my teenage years, and there's a lot of activism in that scene, a lot of awareness around just how people are treated globally, how the world is, how capitalism is super corrupt. And I mean, you know, you throw any sort of large industry under that umbrella and you're going to expose the horrible side of things. And so with that, there was a lot of exposure to the mistreatment of animals in the industrial meat system. And you kind of, you know, it's a lot easier to strike an emotional chord in people when you can put a face to your cause, you know. Like, it's a lot harder for people to get angry at capitalism when it's kind of obscure, but you can see somebody being a douchebag to an animal pretty clearly, you know. Yeah. Like it's not that hard. You don't have to doctor images. It's just happening.
Yeah.
That disturbed me. I didn't like that. I was, you know, I'm a compassionate individual. And so I essentially decided that I was going to stop eating meat based on, you know, protest to the mistreatment of animals in that industry. And then it was more or less, the more that I got educated on the subject, the more it kind of disturbed me, and the more more extreme in my viewpoints I went, essentially. So yeah, it was definitely, it was a transition. It was a process. It wasn't like, I'm going from meat eater to vegan. This is happening.
I was in my late teens. I was a vegetarian, and more for the same reasons. Like, it was because I didn't like how the animals that were on my plate were treated. And we lived in Scotland, and I had very little qualms about eating a pheasant my dad or my brother had shot.
Sure.
As opposed to my mom getting chicken breasts from the store, and that it was just like, in my head, it was like, that one is cruel and this one is, well, it's not awful. But I mean, then it was just nothing. But I was more at peace with something being hunted than I was something being factory raised and mistreated.
Yeah, which, I mean, you know, that to me, it just makes a lot more sense when you think about just your biological wiring. Like, you know, without any sort of like thought or justification of, it's okay for me to do this because I'm a predator and they're a prey. It's like, it seems like a natural way of procuring protein. You know, we're animals, and being animals, hunting for our food is something that happens.
Were you, like, I've had a conversation not too long ago about a family who also, they were vegans, and then they watched Kiss the Ground and they made the jump back into an omnivore lifestyle, but a very ethical, regenerative lifestyle. And she said she struggled, like, it was really hard because, in her words, we weren't very good vegans, because they would let their kids use wax crayons and things like that, which, you know, I think I would never even have considered that. Like, were you just from a food dietary point of view, was it a whole lifestyle?
It really is. I mean, it was more of a lifestyle. Like, I did my best, is the best way that I would put it. You know, I did my best to avoid products, and like, I didn't wear leather, as I wore, you know, Chuck Taylors, but obviously there was glue involved, and it's like, you know, where does it end, you know, in a lot of ways. But it's like, I did, for me, I did my best. I thought about, I was conscientious in my decisions and how it reflected towards the kind of beliefs that I was holding. So I wouldn't say that, I mean, I really don't know if there's a way to truly be completely devoid of animal products in 100% facet in your life in today's world, really. I mean, somewhere along the way, something had to happen.
Which is not a bad thing, because everything is getting used. It's not like you're throwing parts away and it's a waste. It's like total nose to tail, everything is being used, which is a good thing.
It is. It totally is. I mean, there's a really interesting book by Simon Fairley. It's a collection of essays called Meat of Benign Extravagance. And he essentially talks about that conversation that people generally don't have, especially around, you know, veganism or vegetarianism. The argument generally is centered around the treatment of animals. And then it's also centered around, well, if you took X amount of acres that you grow cattle in this style of, you know, raising cattle or pigs or chickens or whatever, and equate that into grain, you can feed more people. And that's an incomplete argument, is essentially what he's bringing forward. Is, you know, the complete argument is yes, but when you grow grain in there, you're depleting the soil, and the soil is what you're actually farming, you know, where that's the actual process that's happening. And it's often overlooked. And then, you know, the argument to say that you can take an acre of one and substitute it for an acre of the other, well, that just doesn't make sense either, because there's a bunch of elements that go into growing plants that they need specific environments and specific climates, and grass is pretty resilient. It kind of does seems to grow everywhere. If you ever walk down a city street, it's coming through the concrete, right? Like, everyone has seen that. You don't see zucchini popping up while you're walking down the street.
No.
So, it, you know, there's something to be said for that, exactly that. It's a weed, you know, and you have it, you have animals, because it's not, you know, specific to cows. Chickens are pretty, they graze as well, and so do pigs. They'll all eat, you know, grazing, not 100% of their diet like a cow does, but they all can supplement through grazing around. They're taking essentially sunshine and turning it into protein, which is pretty amazing when you think about it.
Yeah, and I think people forget that a lot of the land where cattle are grazing and ranging is inhospitable for anything else.
Absolutely.
Tit for tat.
No, it's definitely not a tit for tat. And that's the frustrating part of the argument, is that, you know, on that subject, a lot of the time is it's a tit for tat. It's a kind of looking at one versus the other, you know, and I mean, it's very much that's, it's kind of how we are as a society in a lot of ways. You're either for us or you're against us. And it's like, but that's not how the world is. It doesn't exist in either of those planes.
I live in the gray, areas. I don't believe in black and white. But
gray. Yeah. Oh, the world is in the gray. It's not in the black and white.
No. So what made you make the move? Like, when did you become a butcher? Or maybe I need to take a step back. When or at what point that lifestyle change for you again? So when did you start thinking this isn't for me? Like, were there health implications, or was it just time or effort?
I can't look back on it and go like, this was the pinpoint, this was the reason, you know. I think that it's taken me a while to really figure out how to articulate really where my thought process was and everything else around it. But what I've come to kind of summarize it is that I found that, you know, being somebody that was essentially protesting a system, that doesn't actually accomplish anything. You're just saying, I'm not going to do this, but the system itself isn't going to stop just because you say, I'm not going to do it, because it's just, it's not how capitalism works at the same time. And that's also the planet we're on. So I kind of felt like that abstaining from participating in a system instead of being part of the system, but trying to work towards a change in that system, didn't really make sense to me. You know, like patting myself on the back for saying I'm better than you in a lot of ways. You know, I'm not saying that all vegans are like that at all, but for me, this is how it was saying, you know, sitting there going like, yeah, I'm not doing that. I'm better than you. It was a very holier than thou kind of viewpoint. And that doesn't really get anything done. It never will. It'll never facilitate change. It'll never change someone else's opinion of how the system works or why the system works. And then, you know, so it was still, again, it was conscientious. It was a conscientious change, you know, and it's been the same evolution going forward, where as part of that, then it was, I mean, how I ended up being a butcher, to kind of segue, was I was working jobs. I was working in a grocery store, just, you know, I moved cities, and then I kind of fell into the career. But then in part of that, it really ignited like that conscientious around energy, around food. And I really started to see it all differently and realize that, you know, in that system of meat consumption, we're still, and I mean, I own a butcher shop. It's brutal. We do our best, but the way the system works for the general consumer is they're interested in like three or four different cuts of meat, and there's a whole animal out there. And the way that that works is just, it still doesn't. And the awareness around that is still something that really needs to happen to really change the system. But yeah, I fell into butchery just by working in a store, and the guy was like, hey, you want to come work in the meat department? It'll pay you up to like $17 an hour. And at the time I was making like $7.15. And I was like, that sounds like a lot better deal to me. But because of that, it ended up, you know, igniting this whole kind of conversation. And then I was really, you know, still conscientiously aware, like I was saying, about it all. And I remember visiting my sister in Montreal, and she said to me, you got to come to this restaurant. It was a great restaurant called Au Pied de Cochon with Martin Picard was the chef. And she's like, they're making this amazing stuff, you know, with meat, pork, and it's like, it's beautiful. I'm like, well, what makes it so great? She said, well, the restaurant saves all their scraps and feeds the pigs. And I remember thinking about that and realizing that, oh shit, there's ways you can do this, you know, where it was like, there, you can close this system in all these different, like, it's not this stubborn, you got to grain them, hay them, you know, all this kind of stuff we're stuck in with the industrial meat. I remember like learning about that through this restaurant and what they were doing and being like, whoa. And then it really changed how I looked at how I was doing my job at the same time. And that then snowballed into even, it's the classic, the more you know, the more you don't know scenario. Sure. Yeah. The more educated I got and the more I was conscientious about like both my profession and my beliefs, the more I was just like, okay, what is this really? What is happening? You know, like what is all of this system about, and what is one that makes sense, and what is one that like really kind of, you know, like how does this all work? Like we've eaten meat for centuries, forever as human beings, and we definitely, agriculture's been around for a very long time, but it's only in recent memory has it become so horrendously harmful and unhealthy. Whereas what happened there? You know,
mass production happens.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's frustrating because it goes back to that, you know, what was I said earlier, that vegetarianism, the cause there around animal rights, it's a lot easier for people to identify with, I find, because it has a literal, like, a face and a literal animal suffering behind it in the moment. It's happening. So you can look at it and go, that's really wrong. It's really obscure, and you're really separated from a block of tofu on the counter that's come from a section of land that's been now turned into a monoculture, and it's covered in pesticides, and it's killing the soil and the community around it, and it's going to end up creating a soil deficiency, and then we're going to have this wasteland area that's going to be a desert. That's too separated for us to give a shit about it, plain and simple. And that's a big part of this whole conversation and problem, is that we're stuck in the black and white, and it's all in the gray. And nobody wants to talk about it.
Yeah, but there's
wants to have a mature conversation about it, at least.
I feel like ever since I've started season two of my podcast, that so much stuff has kind of like hit the airwaves and hit the media that I'm like, oh my goodness, I need to talk about all of it. And it's, yeah, you're right. It's the gray areas, and I mean, I respect everyone's beliefs and everyone's choice. It is your choice. But I think the greater issue is being sustainable and regenerative. Like, I think as long as we all kind of abide by those rules, you can do whatever you want. But like, don't shit on me because I don't align with your beliefs. Let's have the same beliefs, even though we have two different verticals of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I had a conversation. I thought it was a very polite and conversational conversation. It was on my page, and someone had called me a murderer, and how could we do this? And I just kind of like said, you know, but do you not know about, you know, the death toll of the vegetables are off the crops and, you know, all like pesticides and like killing the bees and the birds and the rodents and the worms. And her words were, I don't believe you.
Well, then you're just not paying attention. That's the frustration, because, you know, you have these huge combines that end up, like, they chew up fawns because they hide in the field. It's like, that happens. You can't ignore it. It happens. And that's, you know, that's devastating. It is, you know, and that's, it's, the conversation should be centered more around, like you mentioned, the mass conglomerate industrialization. That is, it, whatever you're doing in that regard, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's, you know, these huge factories or to make iPhones or these, any of that is so harmful. All of it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's not unique to any of these aspects, but these, especially this nonsense of non-seasonal worldwide food trucking, you know, the demand for strawberries in January will never make sense to me. No, never.
Tastes right. Like, either.
No, they taste like cardboard. If you've ever had your strawberries from like your yard or in season or anything, like, they don't taste anything like the strawberries you buy at the store. They're also naturally huge. They're bizarre. They're weird. I don't know.
When I first started this, like this whole regenerative program, that came from more from Scott. My input into what we do was the ethical treatment, because I truly believe that it's the meat eaters and it's the people who line the pockets of the industry that are going to make a difference. Like, they don't care if you don't eat it because you're not paying their money. But for the people who do buy the meat or produce the meat, and I feel that we can make more of a difference, even if it's one ranch at a time or one person at a time buying a side of beef as opposed to steaks in a store, that we can slowly chip away at it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree with that more. And I think that even if you're not in the, because I think there's a lot of folks out there that are conscientious shoppers, but the whole idea of purchasing meat by the side is either unattainable based on the initial investment, or the understanding of what do I do with all the cuts becomes such a deep rabbit hole that people just kind of throw their hands up and say, this is crazy, you know, because it's not simple. Most people don't cook anymore. And so to say to somebody like, hey, here's a chunk of, you know, of beef shank. And they're like, well, what the hell do I do with that? You know, and they Delicious. Think that's, yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. But, you know, for us folks that, you know, like live and breathe meat, that's our lives. That's, we have to be able to do those things, right? But there's a lot of folks that, like, I couldn't, like, during this whole pandemic, it's really, for me, it's really shed a light. I mean, my wife and I both shed a light on, like, how truly disconnected people are between the food on their plate and where it comes from, on top of how it even gets there in the first place. You know, the idea that I heard this segment on the CBC about, you bought that squash and you don't know what to do with it. And I was like thinking to myself, squash is like the easiest thing to cook. You almost have to forget about it.
I know.
You put it in the oven and walk away. Like, yeah. how is this something that's daunting for somebody? And it's like, that's not a finger pointing observation. That's a, how did we get here? How did we become so disconnected from cooking that we don't know how to cook simple things like a storage vegetable, you know, something that you can keep through the winter? We don't know how to do that, you know. It's so then to go back to meat, we had a local foodie event here, but a local food event around here that was very much centered around meat, and I was asked to do a presentation at it where I did a live butchery demo, and I chose to do my butchery demo by bringing a whole side of bibeef onto the counter, and then I took out just the steak cuts, so just the tenderloin, just the strip loin, and just the ribeye.
Yeah.
Because most people don't even want a T-bone, so it's just, you know, and if you've ever seen a side of beef and you've seen those three muscles in proportion, there is a dramatic difference between what you have in front of you that most people would consider the cuts that they want, and the rest of it. So the focus of my conversation was around how, just because you don't raise an animal, just because you don't understand how it works, doesn't mean that you can't shop like you have an animal. Doesn't mean that you can't try to equate, I'm going to eat this many of this steaks, and then I'm going to have to force myself out of my comfort zone a little. Maybe I'll try a truck roast. And, you know, if you just start purchasing that way, then that will change the industry. It's inevitable. If people started buying as if they had a whole animal in the freezer, but they just kind of broke it down and went to the store opposite of that. Like it's an abstract concept, I think, for a lot of folks. But if you just shift a little and start buying, you know, some of the stew cuts and don't just buy steaks every single time, that will force the industry to change. It won't have a choice.
No. And it's cheaper too. Like I did a post on some, you know, you want to eat grass-fed beef, but you feel it's too expensive. This is what you need to do. And it was like your chuck steak or your flank steak, which are to me some of the best steaks in the animal. And people just ignore them because they are cheap, but they're delicious. And if cooked right, they're very tender.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, there's also been a bit of a resurgence around that I've seen around the butcher industry as well. It's shifted a lot. It's come back to these like smaller shops and the quote unquote obscure cuts. They're making a comeback, and there are tons of hidden gems in the animal that if you have a skilled butcher in your neck of the woods, go and talk to them. They'll help you find them. You know, I like hooking people up with, you know, a tri-tip or a flat iron steak or a Denver steak, something that where you're like, what do you mean? You don't, well, how do you get that off your cow? Every cow has it, man. Like you got to know where they are and how to cut them. But like a flat iron steak is arguably one of the more tender steaks on the animal. And it's from the shoulder, and it's, you know, your out of pocket price is nowhere near any of the other steaks that you would have to buy. Like, I mean, the cost of all this is not astronomical anymore.
It is.
So, you know, yeah. Oh, and it's just, again, food in general. It's all like, yeah, this spring will be 20 years in the meat industry as well for me, which I don't understand how that happened, but, but it's one of those where like, I look at it and go, I've seen this shift during the course of my career. I saw the tail end of carcass beef coming into grocery stores and that disappearing. And so for those listeners of your podcast that don't know what I say when I mean carcass beef, I mean like beef on the rail that's hanging on a hook that rolls in. They don't do that in grocery stores. They haven't for 15, 16 years of anything. And then on top of that, it's actually getting to become more and more rare that there's actual butcher shops that do that as well. It's just becoming, it's a depreciating skill in the industry, but there is a resurgence. And so I have faith.
there is a lack, like there is a just in, I don't think it's just BC wide. I think it's Northern America, Canada, and the USA that there is a lack of butchers, slaughterhouses and butchers. Like they're almost a dying breed.
Oh, they are. They're a dying breed, and I would say that. So, I have a hilarious rant around where that kind of comes from, which is like,
rant away.
Literally, the if you can piece it back, if you want to go backwards on like how we got here, how the value of the meat cutting skill, how it came to pass, it's reflective of the food industry itself, which totally all the way goes back to McDonald's, which is hilarious that it all stems back from McDonald's. But if you look at their business model, their business model is all based around efficiency. It's based around one movement for some individual that they perfect, and then the next person does the next. So it's like this orchestrated dance of efficiency where everyone is a perfectionist at the one thing they do. That is what's happened across production lines of food, where you have people that are sitting there in a prep kitchen and how all that works. That has also happened in the meat cutting industry. So they've taken that skill away from the individual in the store because it's become around a wage cost essential conversation, right? Because it's again, we're a capitalistic country. So capitalism doesn't care about people, it cares about money. That's just how the system is. And we all joyfully get to live in it. But, and I'm not totally anti-capitalist, it's just fun to throw that in there. But that's what's happened, right? So now you have these centralized cutting facilities that cut and process the animals for grocers. So in these large grocery stores, there's very rarely even meat cutting happening in the store itself, never mind on the carcass. It's usually processed at this central facility that gets either, I don't even know if they get sides. The sides might happen at the slaughterhouse level at this point. But there was a time where it was like slaughterhouse would slaughter it. They'd ship the sides to the central cutting facilities, which would then break them down into retail cuts, which would then vacuum seal them and ship them to all these stores. And then the stores would put them on the shelf, and then that would happen there. So the the way that that helped control all the costs was you only really had to pay the guys that were working in the facilities for that job that they were doing. They didn't know how to break down a cow. They needed to know how to bone out a hip. So that guy that bones out the hip, that's what he does all day. And he, like, he's a wizard at it, or he or she. And it's 2022. I should know better. But they're just sitting there doing that one action all day. And then so their wage cost is reflective of that essentially lack of skill. It's not a lack of skill, but it's like a complete skill. They don't know how to do it all. So their value is just that one piece of the puzzle. And when you start to commodify individuals into this sort of like weird puzzle piece obscurity, then all of the understanding and skill set goes out the window with it. It's just like, you know, it's just like the industrial farming aspect of things. People that, you know, grow potatoes, somebody who's done it their whole life, they've done it, you know, 40, 50 times, maybe tops. They have to pass that skill set on to somebody else directly. If you have these huge conglomerates that are growing these industrial potatoes, they only know how to do it that way. They don't know how to grow potatoes in your yard, right? So it's the same kind of idea on a different scale, but applied to meat. Now in the grocery store, if you're going to chat to an individual about cuts of meat or a steak, it's not totally impossible that you're going to find somebody that doesn't know the full gamut of it, but your likelihood is diminishing by the day. You know, you because we've devalued that skill set to be able to go and talk to that individual in the store, because people don't cook as much as they used to, so that engagement hasn't been demanded, and it's also been taken away from them at the same time. So it's this, we're caught in this weird system that all comes back to McDonald's. That's my favorite. If you really look at it, it stemmed from there, because it really did. You know, I don't know if you've seen that movie with Michael Keaton, The Founder, and it shows the story of like what McDonald's did so differently versus the other drive-in restaurants at the time, and it was dramatic what they did differently. So if you apply that same kind of shift to the meat industry, you can see that that's what's happened. You know, it's essentially the same thing that's just happened there. They've gone, hey, shit, that works, and then applied that to that business model. Wow. So I mean, I always used to say, like, I'm 41, I've been in the meat industry, like I was mentioning, it's been 20 years in the meat industry for me, and up until a few years ago, like I was in my mid-30s, I was like, I'm the youngest butcher that I know, and the next closest one to my age was like 50. And that's changed a lot. There's a lot of younger people in the industry now. I've apprenticed a few folks along the way. You know, with social media, you're seeing that there's a lot of younger people getting into it. But then you see their, you know, levels of experience out there, and a lot of them are within the last like 8 to 10 years. So that tells you that shift is relatively new, you know. Yeah. Like that's not a long time for it to be like a resurgence in the industry. It really is.
Take the money out of the equation. Like, money's not the object. You have an amazing investor who's willing to put up front $2 million, whatever. But because, yeah, I think previously you mentioned that you wanted to change the industry and change the treatment. Like, would you, if you were able to, would you take it from start to end? Like, from receiving the animal to having a steak on your plate?
So I'm going to answer that two ways. I'm going to answer that from the emotional side of things and like the core belief side of things of, you know, of how I view the industry. Absolutely. I would love to be a part of something like that where it has you can see the full compass, because I mean, you know, in our butcher shop, the thing that we don't do is the slaughter aspect of things. In our butcher shop, you can bring us a side of beef and we can turn it into anything you want. Like, when I say anything you want, we make beef jerky in house. We do smoked deli meats. We can make sausages. We can make pepper. Like, there's, the list is very long for the types of products that we can give you. But we don't do the slaughter aspect of things. I think it would be really cool to be able to provide that service for individuals. The other part of that answer is the mental health side of things. So stressful running just a business on its own, that the emotional capacity right now for me, I don't know if I could handle it. Plain and simple, because, you know, I've got a 5-year-old at home, and I feel like I'm missing out on so much already for investing how much you have to invest into a business. So the potential to do it with other folks involved, where I wouldn't have to feel like it's on my wife and I again, probably. But if it was on us to kind of run with that, I don't know. I couldn't do that.
No. I mean, we have to sort cows monthly to send to slaughter, and I cry every month. Like it just cuts me deeply every single month. And in ways, I'm glad it does, because if that gets switched off, then it's time to stop doing this, because you need to have compassion. But the emotional drain, I don't think people realize that it's not easy. It's not easy for us, but we're providing a service too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and that's the difficulty for us, right? Like we, I don't think people realize fully the, what it feels like when you care about what you're doing and then you care about the individual on the other side. I process other people's livestock. You know, that's, there's a lot of responsibility there. And I don't think that it's fully appreciated how much responsibility falls on the individual's shoulder for here, because you took the time and energy to raise that. An animal lost its life. And now it's on me to make sure that you're satisfied as the individual and that I've respected the animal in the process by giving you the most out of that animal that I can do. And there's a lot of weight to that, you know, where you have a huge influx of people that they've invested their, because we get a big influx in the fall every year. And then there's a lot of individuals that are, they've raised their two pigs and they've, as you, become emotionally connected to the animals, which is a beautiful thing. And you should have that emotional connection. So when you have an individual that has that emotional connection to the food that they've raised themselves, and they've put the they've gifted you with the responsibility of providing their family with that food, a lot falls on our shoulders. And so the pressure of not getting it wrong is pretty high, because there is no redos in this industry. If I cut something wrong, it's wrong. I can't fix it.
There's no
I can't shim it and, you know, put some buffers in there or whatever carpenters do to make things more sound. I can't do that. Once it's done, it's done. It's gone. There's not another pig that I can just take from and, oh, it's fine. It's, you know, it, no, it doesn't work that way. Your beef is your beef, and I have to give you back your beef. I can't just sub it in with whatever else, because that's not right. That's not the point.
So you do hear some horror stories.
Oh my God. They go a long way back, the horror stories of the meat industry. I've only heard a few of them, but yeah. The good old days of smoking in the cooler and, you know, dunking chickens in bleach when they start to go a little sour.
Yeah, oh my God. No, okay. I was told. I haven't heard those ones.
These were, I never, thankfully, I never worked through that. I was, you know, the health board and food safe regulations and public safety had become to the forefront, but
The
good old days.
Good old days.
But, you know, the distrust in butchery has its roots.
But I think butcheries are becoming really popular now. Like, a lot of times, like, there, people like to go into the butchers and buy something, which is great. Like, it is a step in the right direction. Like, I don't think we've
been in
the store for years. Years and years and years and years. We go to a butcher, or it's from my freezer.
Yeah. Field. Yeah. As a butcher, it was always a thing that I would go and check out in cities, but there's definitely more. There's definitely more. And there's definitely, you know, a younger breed of folks coming into it too. I mean,
I hope so.
The resurgence into carcass and hanging animals is there, and it's tough to get people to wrap their head around that. Like, we stubbornly held on to being a whole animal butcher shop for many years. And I think if we were still doing it, we probably would have put ourselves out of business, because we used to not bring anything in unless it was a whole animal. Now, you can't do that when you run a business, unfortunately, because you can't just make your customers angry every time they come in the door. You know, like, there's only so many steaks, and if you can't balance out the rest of it financially, well, that's not your customer's fault. That's your business decision. So, you know, we did that for a while, and we were like, it's okay. We'll be able to educate people, because we live in a very food conscious area of the world, which we do. And I believe that. And I believe that you can educate people. And I believe that all of this change is completely possible, although I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. But there is such a thing as going too much too soon. You know, like, we're not in the position of, we can go back to whole animal butcher shops. It's not the way our world is set up right now. And it sucks that that's the way that it is. But we can still offer people sides of beef. We can still Like, we bring in sides of pork and just supplement with a little bit of stuff that people are looking for. That's how we do it, because that's the way it is. But yeah, it's we can still have the conversation. We can still be there to educate people. We can still, you know, we can still be there to talk about it, because that, and that's part of why I love putting in like the oddball cuts into the counter. People are like, never heard of this before. What's this? It's like, well, yeah, this comes from here, and this is why you should try this, right?
Yeah. We we offer packs, meat packs, and custom orders, and people can choose whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
But our most popular item, like, we sell it leagues above everything else, is a quarter cow, which is
really
amazing. Yeah, that's the we sell more quarters than anything else. We sell more quarters than we do 10-pound packs of ground.
What's your clientele like? What's your reach? I know you guys are over in Grand Fork side of things.
But our reach, we deliver from the coast all the way to Nelson. And we've even done Caslo and Creston, if it's a border. But mainly it's from Vancouver to Nelson. And we process 15 cows a month, every month. And the majority of them are all, and our quarters are mixed. They're not front or hind. They're a mixed quarter.
Yeah, we've called that a half of a half for a long time in our world. Yeah. And I feel like a mixed quarter, it's a hard thing to describe to folks, because people will be like, what do you mean by mixed quarter? I'm sure you get that question a lot.
Now, we used to, or people just want a hind, because the hind has the better steaks apart from your
partner. Wrong. Sorry.
It is wrong. It is wrong. Exactly. It is. But that is their belief.
That one drives me crazy.
Yeah. But a quarter, like, we sell more quarters than anything else.
Yeah. I would way rather have a front of beef, though. It's like, you always know, you get the brisket and the shank and the short ribs, and you can do a couple of different ways. You also get, you know, the skirt steak. You also get your prime rib or your ribeye or your back ribs if you want them. And I mean, a chuck roast is my favorite beef roast. It's, yeah, I think people are just wrong on the hind quarter.
They are, which is why we
do. You get the tenderloin, sure, but sure. God.
Yeah,
but yeah, I don't know. I'm a fat eater, though, so maybe that's why I like the front.
maybe. So, if you have a varied clientele, or even like the people that you want to convert, even if you had one thing, like, this is your direct channel to say something profound to your audience or to the world, what would it be? Like, what would be your one closing statement to kind of try and change people's minds in the industry as a whole?
You should care about your food, plain and simple. I don't feel like I needed to convince anybody of giving a shit about what they put into their body. I feel like the fact that we've become so disconnected as a society that we don't care, and we think it's perfectly fine to, you know, drink Coca-Cola, which we know takes rust off of nails, or, you know, that it's fine to like buy food at a gas station. It doesn't, we've lost that connection to food. Start caring about what you put in your body. We've become, you know, and especially it's so aggravating when you look at today's climate and you have this pandemic that's going on, and not to bring this into it, but it's a good way to kind of look at it and go like, yeah, but you have the anti-vaxxers saying, don't put that shit into my body. And then they're eating Doritos and drinking Pepsi. It's like, what is wrong with you? You know, like, how can you not care about that you're doing every day? And I'm for choice. I'm, you know, I have, my mom's a vegetarian. I have lots of friends that are vegan. You do you. That's the beauty of the world. But as you said before, we need to come together on how we do things. It's not the choice that you make. It's the systems that we have that really we need to focus on. We need to be more regenerative, and we need to care for ourselves. It starts there. We start caring about what we're doing and what we're putting into our bodies. Then there will be positive change, because you'll feel better, and then you'll be nicer to everyone around you.
It's just
part and parcel. You know, I'm not the type of person that's going to try to talk somebody into being pro meat or anti meat or pro vegetarian. I just want to have conversations with people about these sorts of topics.
Yeah,
because I think that's where change happens. It doesn't happen from vilifying anybody for anything. And the minute you say that I'm right and you're wrong, we've both lost. And I think that's really where we're at, where we need to change.
Agreed. Agreed. I don't care what your choice is, but just be sustainable and regenerative in that choice.
hope you enjoyed listening to Ben as much as I enjoyed talking with him. Stay tuned for the next episode in a couple of weeks. We have some amazing interviews lined up.